I think when you start your own firm and you own your talent, you can really chart your own destiny. And I think the other benefit is it frees you up from all of these kinds of restrictive forms of thinking. If you want to have a workplace where parents can be partners or at the firm, you set up a firm that, you know, focuses on those lifestyle benefits. If you want to have a firm that's going to, you know, change the law in a certain way, you can focus on taking those kinds of cases. So I just think that it allows you to make a bigger impact on the world.
Today on Law Next, I am thrilled to be joined by my longtime friend, Carolyn Elefant. You know her as the creator of MyShingle.com, the longest running blog on solo and small law firm practice. She's also a practicing solo lawyer herself with a national practice fighting climate change. And she just released the third edition of her book that is a Bible for lawyers going off on their own, Solo by Choice, How to Start a Law Firm and Be the Lawyer You Always Wanted to Be. This is Bob Ambrosi, and you are listening to Law Next, the podcast that features the innovators and entrepreneurs who are driving what's next in law. Before we get to today's interview, let's hear about the sponsors who make this podcast possible. Ready to level up your law firm? Practice Panther is the all-in-one practice management solution for lawyers who are ready to automate and grow their practice. With multiple timers to accurately capture time, built-in payment processing, unlimited e-signatures, and two-way business text messaging, lawyers have the power to manage their firm in just a few clicks. Learn why Practice Panther is the preferred solution for tens of thousands of lawyers at practicepanther.com. Now on to my interview with Carolyn Elefant. Carolyn, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, it's good to be here.
It's always fun to talk to you because, as you know, but as listeners won't know, our careers have kind of intersected so many times over the years and over, unfortunately, an increasing number of years. I mean, you and I both started our blogs within a month of each other, and this year is the 20th anniversary of our blogs. Isn't that crazy?
Yes, I know. And it's crazy. And it's also, I don't feel like saying you've been around for 20 years is really so much of a great thing anymore. I mean,
yeah, well, it doesn't feel that way anymore. But in addition to that, we for a number of years wrote the Legal Blog Watch for American Lawyer Media for law.com, which was something that doesn't exist anymore, but was something where we switched authoring duties every other day or so, covering what was going on in the world of legal blogs, which was kind of an anomaly in and of itself.
Yeah, that was a good gig. I enjoyed that. I mean, I enjoyed it to the point where I didn't feel like I could continue doing it. I was always afraid I was going to make some grievous mistake that would get printed, but it was a good gig while it lasted for me. Anyway,
yeah, it was fun.
I liked it.
It was fun. But that was when, you know, covering blogs was something that was kind of feasible to do because there were still so few blogs in those years, and you could go out and survey what was being talked about on different blogs and write about it. Now I don't know how you would ever do that, and I don't think you could do that. So, you know, what about you? I mean, you have been called the patron saint of solo and small firms, and of course, you've just come out with this new edition of your book, which we'll talk about. But before we talk about the book, I just want to ask how you got started on this path of educating others about how to build successful small firm practices.
So I guess it started because when I started my firm, I didn't feel that there was anybody who really spoke to me or the experience that I had. I guess I started my firm, I'd been practicing for about 5 years, and I went to like a top 15 law school where they didn't have a lot of professors who really talked about solo practice. So when I started my firm, I read the Foomberg book, but I was practicing even back then in doing energy work. So, you know, going to the Kiwanis Club wasn't really going to help me market my practice. And then, of course, you know, all the stuff about having to have a physical office didn't really serve me either, because the first year I was basically working out of my house with a virtual office. So I wanted to have a resource so that people who felt they didn't have any other choice in law and didn't like working at a big firm, but still wanted to continue to practice, would see that there were options where they could continue with their practice areas and do it in a way that was flexible and not necessarily the traditional path. So I guess I started the blog to just really focus on those topics. And then it evolved into other issues too, like just also looking at the role of solo and small firms sort of in the bigger picture, the ecosystem of the legal profession, because everything geared towards solos and smalls was also just very practical and how-to in nature. And there wasn't any study of the role that they play with access to justice, competition, and sort of these bigger picture issues. I mean, more recently, my focus has been on how law firm ownership helps advance diversity in the profession, both gender and racial diversity. So there wasn't, I always like to focus on those pictures also, or the innovation that solo and small firms bring. None of that was really being written about at the time that I started my blog. So it filled that void.
Yeah. And just recently, you've been doing a series on women solo practitioners, which has been really interesting.
Yeah, I had done a similar series 2 years ago, and so I revived it for this year for Women's History Month.
Yeah, it's funny because you mentioned that when you started out, you mentioned Funberg, which probably some people listening to this who have no idea who Funberg was, but Funberg used to be the man when it came to this whole area. I mean, Jay Funberg had a book on how to start a law practice and. Spoke regularly at every bar association meeting and, yes. and all of that, and was very well regarded. In some ways, I don't want to say you're the new Jay Funberg, but I don't even know if his book is still in print. It may well be, but I can't imagine it's current anymore. So I don't know what's happened to Jay. I used to see him around all the time. But so you have just put out your third edition of your book. And I wonder if you could just kind of tell us generally about the book, but then also why you decided to do a third edition of it. What change that you felt needed to be addressed or updated?
So the book, I guess I call the book both a why to and how to book. It's different from a lot of the practice management books in that it talks about why people might want to start a law firm. And the first edition of the book came out before the economy tanked. It was like, or it was written like right before the economy tanked. And so a lot of people were, people were going to law school and graduating and finding work, and they weren't terribly as much in debt as they are now. And so it was really more to persuade people to consider that option. The second edition was really more at a time when, people had lost their jobs. And where law schools were so desperate to get people placed that they were just telling them to take anything like legal adjacent. And my feeling was that if you have a law degree and you enjoy that work, that's fine. But otherwise, you should start your firm. So it's always made the case for why you might want to consider starting. And then it has a how-to, and it's always been written with an eye to the future. So I've never really described in all of the books the reason why they've stayed more current than they should have is that I was always writing about what was coming. So even in the first book, I was talking about like my case and Clio and practice management systems and social media and everything like that. So this last edition, though, I felt was necessary for a couple of reasons. I mean, first of all, the previous edition was from 2013. So much has changed since 2013. I mean, I just went back and kind of, looked at some of the things that had changed. I mean, like now, document automation is really something that's being adopted by many solo and small firms. Legal outsourcing, there's so many different platforms for hiring contract lawyers, getting gig workers to do design. I mean, those things have changed. And then, of course, there was the pandemic, which has caused everybody to have do a 360 on, what the workplace looks like, what you can expect from your employees. And just, a lot of people are also, you have the whole big quit. And a lot of lawyers are thinking, do I really want to be working for somebody else? Can I, is this something I can do myself? So I had started writing the third edition before the pandemic, but then the pandemic happened. And so I incorporated all of those considerations too.
So with the big quit, is it fair to say more lawyers are at least thinking about starting their own practices?
At least that's how it seems to me, at least anecdotally. I mean, in some of the Facebook groups that I'm in, there are definitely lawyers who are, been working for the state or for large firms who are thinking about starting their own practices, especially women. I think also there's people who are thinking, there's sort of that group of people who are thinking of starting firms. And then there's also, as you know, there's more of a movement towards entrepreneurship in the law and legal tech. And some of the people who have read my book or read my work have started legal tech companies to sort of as an outlet for that entrepreneurial spirit. But there are other people who are looking to start law firms that kind of straddled the line or offer, you know, more innovative services like the Hello Divorce kind of model or some kind of hybrid sort of model. So there's a lot of people, I think, who are thinking of starting firms because they see more, they are starting to see more opportunity. It's not just for lifestyle and balance. It's also, I think, opportunity as well.
It's interesting you talk about some lawyers who have an entrepreneurial bent go into doing a tech startup, perhaps, but others go into starting a firm. Do you think a lawyer needs to be entrepreneurial to start their own firm?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. I'm on the fence about that because if you have, I think there are some attorneys who start their firms and they have a particular expertise and you know that's able to attract clients and they maybe can focus more on doing the law. So I guess they wouldn't necessarily consider themselves entrepreneurial, but I guess you've got to be thinking about, you know, whatever you're doing, you've got to be thinking about how it's going to make money and pay your bills. Right. So whether that's entrepreneurship or just survivorship, I'm not sure. I mean, I think where the difference is if you're going to grow or scale your firm, and the word scale is like the big, you know, is the word people, I mean, they use it in tech, but they use it with law firms now. I think then you really have to be much more entrepreneurial in nature and think much more about the business that you're running. But I think that you can run something smaller and more focused or more specialized and not necessarily, you know, beyond just figuring out how you're going to make money at it. That would be the extent of the entrepreneurial spirit that you would need.
Yeah. I have my copy of your third edition right here on my desk, my autographed copy. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. And you add a chapter at the end of the book that talks about the impact of COVID-19 on solo and small firms. I wonder if you could just speak to that. I mean, how do you think the pandemic has changed the landscape for smaller firms? Has it been, you know, I don't want to say positive because we don't like to talk about the pandemic as having been positive, but we do often talk about the fact that there were these benefits that came about through the pandemic in terms of their impact on some aspects of law practice. So was the pandemic, you know, good or bad in terms of its impact on smaller law practices?
I think for smaller firms that were already virtual or had virtual capabilities or were working remotely, I think the pandemic was a huge boon because it reinforced the business model. It gave those firms a lot more credibility. And while other firms that were more traditional were still scrambling to kind of get things together, those firms were just off to the races because people still needed attorneys. They still needed estate planning and divorce attorneys and immigration. So those firms, I think, really benefited and have grown quite a bit. I think where some of the challenges that solo and small firms are facing because of the pandemic is that just as the Big Quit is inspiring people to leave big law, it may also be inspiring people to leave small law, whether they're paralegals who want to start their own independent operation or maybe a newer associate who's tired of working for a small firm. And I think that firms that are not willing to consider remote work or working remotely, even now that people are going back to the office, I think they are going to be struggling. So, you know, even though the pandemic is over, we're kind of going back to business as usual. Those are things they have to think about. And I think the other thing is I think all firms have realized, you know, that with like remote depositions and remote court hearings, I mean, I think it has had an impact on firms that were billing for that kind of stuff. I think maybe experiencing a little bit of financial stress, but I think overall they're also, it frees up so much more time to be able to do that kind of stuff remotely.
After 20 years of helping solo and small firm lawyers start and build their practices, Carolyn Elefant has been sometimes called the patron saint of small firms, other times the guru of small firms. On her blog and in her book, She delivers practical advice on succeeding as a solo. When we return, we'll get into some of her advice, from why start your own firm in the first place to what to do if your practice is struggling. But first, let's hear about the sponsors whose generosity supports this podcast. Paradigm is changing the way lawyers manage their practices with three industry-leading practice management solutions: Practice Panther, Bill for Time, and Meriscase, as well as the online payment solution Headnote and the legal accounting software TrustBooks. In the office or on the go, Paradigm's suite of solutions stretches the boundaries of where your practice can grow. More than 40,000 lawyers trust Paradigm to automate and simplify their practices. Learn more at joinparadigm.com. Welcome back to Law Next. I am speaking with my longtime friend Carolyn Elefant, who's just released the third edition of her book, Solo by Choice: How to Start Your Own Law Firm and Be the Lawyer You Always Wanted to Be, which I think can be fairly described as an instruction manual for starting and growing a law practice. As we return to our conversation, I wondered, why go solo in the first place? What are the advantages for a lawyer of going solo as opposed to other options for law practice? We pick up our conversation there. Although the book is called Solo by Choice, you make clear that it's not just for solo lawyers. It's for a broader community of solo and small firm lawyers. I wonder, why go solo? I mean, what are the arguments? If you're an attorney, you know, working at a firm, have a comfortable job somewhere, what are the advantages of going solo?
So I see so many reasons, but the biggest one that I see is that it gives you an opportunity to own your talent. Even if you're working for the biggest firm in the world and you're making millions of dollars, you're still working for somebody else. It's somebody else's clients. I mean, and maybe it's your client, but you know, they've come to the firm and you're the attorney who's servicing them, at least in many of those cases. And you're always going to be worrying about what's going to happen. I think it becomes a much more reactive lifestyle. I think when you start your own firm and you own your talent, you can really chart your own destiny. And I think the other benefit is it frees you up from all of these kinds of restrictive forms of thinking. It really, if you want to have a workplace where, you know, as one attorney in the book, Rebecca Geller, where parents can be partners or at the firm, you set up a firm that, you know, focuses on those lifestyle benefits. If you want to have a firm that's going to, you know, change the law in a certain way, you can focus on taking those kinds of cases. So I just think that it allows you to make a bigger impact on the world. And it's not necessarily a permanent situation. I mean, you can start a firm and eventually go back to working for somebody else or become a judge or work for a legal technology company or do different things. But I think it's important, especially for lawyers, to understand the value of their talent, because a lot of them don't. And I think that's why the experience of working for other people is often very soul-sucking.
I think there's those are great points. I think some people, some lawyers in particular, have a perception that it's really hard to be successful as a solo lawyer and to make a good living as a solo lawyer. Is that true?
You know, it's very mixed. I mean, the people you always hear from are the people who are doing well. The people who are posting in Facebook are always like, I started from nothing and now I'm making, you know, I've got a seven-figure law firm. I've got all these people working for me. So I definitely see so many examples of people who are working on their own and doing really well. There are also solos who I think more like a silent majority who you don't hear from who are probably struggling. But I mean, if you look at like the financial data in the book, I mean, even in situations where, you know, a lawyer is making like, I think the studies have shown like the median income of solos is maybe like between $150,000 or $180,000, which isn't bad considering that you have the flexibility of working for yourself. And it's, you know, I mean, it's higher than the, you know, what you make as a teacher or other positions. So I don't know if people would consider that struggling. And then of course there's solos who practice like in rural areas. And, you know, I know that that can be challenging. I've seen that some solos have had some difficulty, even though there's such a huge demand for lawyers, there's also the price restrictions. And I think some of that is also changing with technology. And I think you see that lawyers are figuring out ways to use forms and rely on paralegals to make more money, to make practice areas more profitable that once weren't.
Do you get lawyers reaching out to you looking for advice?
I do. I mean, through my blog, I get emails and questions about starting a firm, things like that. So
what do you do when that happens? Do you do that, or do you kind of say it's not my business? I'm a writer, not an advisor.
So I don't like coaching, but I typically meet with people or give people feedback if they have ideas on starting a firm or if they're stuck in a place or if they are looking for a different direction. I'll usually talk to people like that. But one of the things that I am finally doing with Solo by Choice is I'm putting together a course on starting a firm, which is going to be, it's very granular in nature. So it even goes beyond like some of the state bars have these, you know, mm-hmm. start a solo practice day mm-hmm. or something like that, where they go through the ethics rules and it's very theoretical. But this is something that really shows you everything from like how to get your domain name, set up your email, things that we know how to do. Mm-hmm. But when you're starting out, you know, and you've been working for somebody else, you may not know how to do it and you're scrambling all over. There's really nothing where it's all in, all that stuff is in one place. So, yeah. So that's what I'm putting together. And that's what I prefer to do than to do coaching yeah. for people.
Yeah. And I would bet a course like that, even as you say, we know a lot of that stuff. I bet a lot of people starting a practice actually know it as well. But a course like that can give you the reassurance that you're crossing all your T's and dotting all your I's, because that's, I think that what I remember years ago when the first time I started my own law practice, it was just this anxiety about what am I missing? What am I forgetting? What am I not doing? And there were no, I mean, right. there was Jay Foonberg actually way back when I started my practice, but you know, and that was useful, but you still have that concern that, you know, maybe you're doing something wrong that you shouldn't be doing or something like that.
But. Yeah. Yeah. I also have another product. That's just like all the, it's the retainer agreement and all the other types of forms and agreements that you might use in a law practice, not just for serving clients, but like for independent contractors or website terms and conditions. There's a lot of things that the bar associations anyway don't address and that, you know, people will just frequently try to ask a colleague for. Yeah. So
from what you've seen in writing about this and talking with lawyers who started their own practices, are there a couple of sort of really common mistakes lawyers make that they shouldn't do when they're starting a practice? I mean, what's the biggest mistake a lawyer makes when they're starting a practice?
I know I shouldn't. I would say the biggest mistake is locking into high cost services, whether it be a high cost coaching service or a high cost SEO service, a high cost and long term contract. I think that's the biggest mistake. And those are some of the saddest calls that I have gotten are people who are, you know, locked into some $2,000 a month program or practice or product that they can't get out of. And as a result, they've kind of got to, you know, do everything themselves to do what was supposed to be covered by the contract and also run their practice. So I think that's the biggest mistake I see. Even locking into a long-term lease, especially now when it's so uncertain as to whether people, you know, what the office is going to look like. So I would say, you know, just for like the first 6 months or 1 year, just avoid anything long term, because I mean, if it's like $10 a month, then you know it's not a big deal. But anything long term that's really beyond your cost or that's been sold to you as an investment, because you just don't know, and it locks you down so much and puts so much pressure on you from the beginning.
Yeah, that's a really interesting answer. Not what I expected you to say, although I don't know what I expected you to say, but
yes.
I think that's really perceptive, because I mean, on the SEO side, I hear all the time exactly what you're saying. Lawyers who get locked into long-term contracts around SEO and with companies that don't necessarily do a good job around SEO. So they're not even really getting the benefit of it in some cases. And then on the coaching side, I mean, that's really become a much more common phenomenon, lawyers offering these kinds of coaching services. So, you know, it's something to watch out for. What about the issue of, again, when you're kind of starting out, obviously you're a lot of lawyers going into a practice have already been practicing in a particular area of law, or maybe they're coming out of law school with an interest in an area of law. But what should they be thinking about in terms of how they focus their practice and in the areas of law they want to focus on?
So I think the best practice area to pick is something that you're really passionate about or excited about or have had personal experience with that has motivated you to want to change that area. So, I mean, a lot of successful family law attorneys have unfortunately either experienced divorce either in their own relationship or their parents' relationship, and they've seen how it can go wrong. And so they start their firm and it, you know, they're motivated to come up with ways to make the experience better. So if you can focus on something that you have a personal connection to or that moves you, I think that always, it makes you a better attorney and it just makes you more excited about what you're doing. I think also looking at some of these future issues, things, you know, new issues that are coming up like decriminalization of marijuana, NFTs, and the metaverse, all of those kinds of issues. I mean, you can't go wrong looking at these new emerging issues. And the value for a newer attorney is that nobody really knows about this stuff. It's like when I started my practice and I was doing this ocean energy work, and there were only like two people who knew about ocean energy. So, you know, if a client was going to choose between me and somebody, you know, a really experienced energy attorney, I still had a leg up, or at least I was on an even playing field. So I would say also looking at these new emerging areas where, you know, the law is still uncertain and nobody has a competitive advantage to you.
Yeah. What's your advice for somebody starting out in terms of how to build up momentum for their practice, bring in clients when they're just getting started?
So it's just, I would say talk about it, talk about your firm early and often. I mean, even what I see lawyers, another common mistake I see is the analysis paralysis, planning and waiting to launch until everything is perfect and kind of keeping it in stealth mode for like 6 months or 8 months. And then, you know, making the announcement and having to start that be your starting point. If you start talking about your firm like months before you start and tell people like what you're doing and what you're building, you know, you'll have people waiting to send you cases once you get started. If you're able to do that, you know, if you're still working at a job, you're limited in what you can say. And then, you know, the easiest places to start again are the most obvious. Just, I think I saw somebody on Facebook say, you know, every so often he does a post saying, reminding people what areas he practices in law. You forget that a lot of your referrals may come from people who are just personal friends in your community. So just talking a lot about what you do just in your personal social media channels or to people who you meet, that kind of thing. And then I guess the other thing is to, you know, use, again, some kind of pick a social media platform, whichever one you think your target clients are going to be at, and just like rock everything out of it. I mean, whether it's LinkedIn or Facebook or Instagram, you don't have to pick a whole bunch of them, but just pick one and just like, you know, do something on it every day and just be consistent and reach out to people, ask for referrals and those kinds of things.
Yeah. So, what about blogging? Well, you and I have both blogged for two decades now. Is that still a good way to build up a practice?
So, you know, I've always been big. So blogging, I'm more familiar with the blogging from my non-practice area.
Yeah.
I used to blog.
Both you and I blog about stuff that has nothing to do with what we do in our law practices.
Yeah. So, I mean, for my law firm, the best development tool has always been, I had like an ebook online, and then I had, I did the newsletter, and then I would just post the newsletter. It's kind of newsletter blog. They're really the same thing in a way. It's just they're published differently. Yeah. I mean, it's updated information, right. But the blog didn't work for that. But I know that blogging still is working for, you know, even in a very crowded field, if you do a blog consistently, it still can be helpful with SEO and things that people are searching for. So if you like writing, then that would be the way to do it. So
yeah. You know, you mentioned earlier that, you know, some solos are very sort of conspicuously successful. Solos in small firms are very conspicuously successful. Yeah. And there are others out there who probably are struggling. What advice do you have for a struggling lawyer? I mean, is there a point at which they should say, you know, this isn't working, I should just do something else? Or should they look at maybe changing the focus of their practice? Or what are ways that a struggling lawyer can perhaps recover or at least make a decisive turn one way or the other in terms of how to go forward?
So I think the first thing a struggling lawyer has to do is really think about if they've done everything. Sometimes when I talk to lawyers who are having some challenges and I suggest things, it's like, that won't work for me. I can't do that. This won't So at some point, you do have to experiment with doing things differently just to see whether it's going to work or not. And I think sometimes lawyers who are consistently struggling may not be trying those different things. I think it could, I mean, it's possible it could be something that's a practice area. I mean, if you find yourself, you know, advertising for clients and then not really wanting to do the work or having it take a long time, so you're not bringing in new clients, that may be a signal that maybe what you're working on isn't so interesting to you, and maybe exploring another field could be something that's more interesting. But I guess at some point, you would have to ask yourself if what you're doing is really what you want to do. And some people feel, you know, they feel as if they failed if they run a solo practice that isn't economically viable. And that is so far from the truth. I mean, I think that anybody who has the guts to go out and start something from nothing and make money at it, even if you only make $10,000 and it doesn't work out, that still, in my mind, puts you light years ahead of somebody who's always been at a safe job and has a paycheck coming to them and hasn't had to go out and ask somebody to pay a bill. So sometimes starting a firm, you know, again, it may not work out for you, but it can lead to something else. I mean, and you know, one thing it does lead to, I've seen that there have been solo practitioners who have, you know, transitioned to the burgeoning legal technology mm-hmm. positions, which, you know, are kind of, you know, in sales facing roles or community building roles, where they, you know, they have that experience that they've gotten working for themselves is very transferable. So I think, you know, ultimately, it's hard for people to quit something because they feel as if they failed, but they haven't. And legal careers are exceedingly long. You see people doing stuff into their 80s or 90s. If you don't change it up throughout it, you're going to become very stagnant and just get too bored to be able to do anything, I guess.
Right. What's your take on the idea of lawyers freelancing for other lawyers? I mean, there's a couple of sort of, you know, matchmaking services out there now that help match freelance lawyers with other lawyers who need help. You know, and there's two sides to that. There's the side of the lawyer who's maybe thinking, maybe I should hire somebody else, but I don't quite have enough work to hire somebody else. Maybe they might want to use a freelancer. And then maybe there's the lawyer who's struggling a little bit in their practice or just starting out in their practice and needs a little extra work. They might possibly benefit from a market like that. I mean, what's your take on those markets? Are they worthwhile to explore?
Yeah, I think I do tell solos when they're starting out, they should definitely seek out freelancing opportunities because it's the quickest way to bring money through the door. And whether you do it through a platform or do it through your own personal connections, it's just going to depend on what you're offering. I mean, a lot of those services don't necessarily, they do more research and writing and not necessarily like doing appearance work or deposition work, which might be harder to find, but which lawyers would like. So I think it's great for lawyers who have busy practices to be able to get people to come in and work because it allows them to grow with taking less risk and figure out like what their needs are for the future. And I think for lawyers, I think if they're freelancing to fill the cracks, I think it makes sense. I think it is very difficult to make, I mean, there are some attorneys who have their own sort of private freelance businesses who do very well. I think I would think it would be difficult to support yourself full time on a platform. But I guess if you are working part time, you know, it does allow for more options. But the one thing that does kind of get my craw is like, I saw this article a couple of years ago talking about, oh, well, all these freelance options, this is so great for women lawyers. Well, yeah, it's nice to have that work, but at the same time, you're not, you know, it's it's not like owning a firm or being the principal. You're at somebody else's whim. You're a nomad. So it's not, I don't necessarily consider that to be an improvement in how things were before.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, what about the flip side of that? I mean, what if you're running a small, maybe you started a solo practice and, you know, your caseload is starting to pick up. Do you have any thoughts on how you evaluate whether, you know, just start to hire some freelance help or look to hire an associate or bring in, you know, an extra paralegal or something? How do lawyers think about that, when they should hire versus just get temporary or part-time help?
So I think, having the freelancers available allows for that kind of flexibility to figure out if it's just a short-term need or if it's something that can grow. I think the conventional wisdom is to just hire the less qualified or least qualified person who can do a job. So there's a lot of things that a really good paralegal can do right now, and they might be a preferable hire to a freelancer. And then in terms of hiring an associate, I mean, it's really just a matter of figuring out, again, if you have enough of a caseload and enough needs that the associate can, you know, so that you can recover the cost of the associate and make, there's metrics like 2x their salary for profit. I think that's like what the metric is. And so, so they usually tell you to hire, I guess the conventional wisdom is to hire, you know, sooner than you think you need somebody. Rather than waiting. And that's the benefit of the contract lawyers, is you can kind of use them to bridge the gap for a long time. And I guess the other thing is at some point a contract lawyer may become an uneconomic. I mean, if you're paying somebody like $75 mm-hmm. an hour, whereas you could hire an associate whose effective salary might only be, you know, like $100,000, they're really making like $50 an hour. So, you know, if you find you're spending so much on contract lawyers, and that's usually what I see happen, people realize, they look at their bills, they see they've paid so much for contract lawyers that just makes more sense to hire, being a full-time hire.
Yeah, that makes sense. I wonder if that 2x metric is different. I mean, it would be a little different if you're basically working virtually, right? I mean, because you don't have the physical space to worry about as much. I mean, I suppose most solos probably still have an office somewhere, but maybe you don't then need that second office or whatever.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think, you know, it's funny because a lot of people say that, like, with a virtual office, they can, you know, offer lower rates. But I think there's also some solos and small firms who have gone from a full-time office to remote who are just pocketing the profit because a lot of the cost shifts to the employees who are working from home, at least for the space. I mean, most people who have employees working remotely are providing them with computer equipment and other types of things.
Yeah,
paying for their internet.
Yeah, I know. I'm just peppering you with questions here, with lots of things I want to ask you about. But just a couple more. One thing I wanted to ask you about is, and you, I think you talk a little bit about this in the book, is just this. You know, we've seen this kind of loosening of the regulatory structure around who can deliver legal services and how legal services can be delivered, particularly in Utah and Arizona. But there's certainly other things being done around the country. What do you think the impact of that loosening of professional regulations might be on solo and small firm lawyers?
I think there's two components. I mean, first, I think it depends a little bit on how it's implemented. One of the things that really gets my goat is when these new legal services are not subject to the same types of ethics restrictions or requirements that lawyers are, and not so much with malpractice insurance. I mean, I wouldn't expect a non-lawyer company to have carry malpractice insurance, but just for things like advertising, where a non-lawyer company can say, we're the best at what we do, but the lawyer who's the estate planning lawyer can't say he's the best at what he can do. So just like little things like that would really go a long way to leveling the playing field. If you're advertising something related to legal services, the rules should apply equally across the board. So that's the first thing. But on the flip side, I also think the non-lawyer, the loosening of the regulations, I think is a big opportunity for solo and small firms. One of the examples I think I put in the book is in Arizona, where now it's much, well, they've gotten completely gutted 5.4, right? So you can they've partner with somebody Arizona, who's not an attorney.
Yep.
Yeah. And so there was an estate planning lawyer who used to work with a financial planner, and he would, you know, either send cases through to the financial planner, or sometimes his clients just, you know, they wouldn't go to the financial planner, and so they just got lazy and they didn't go. Now he's a partner with the financial planner, so they're able to offer these, you know, these hybrid services together all in one place. It's a benefit to the lawyer, it's a benefit to the client. It makes for a seamless experience. I mean, the other thing that lawyers need to realize is lawyers can do a lot of this stuff plus more. I mean, LegalZoom can only offer forms, or legal services through affiliate agreements or however they do it. Lawyers can do both of that. They can have a product division and they can have a law firm and send the stuff back and forth. So I think there's a lot of lawyers who complain about this change in rules, but if they were thinking straight, they'd be thinking, how can I capitalize on something like that?
Yeah, although they face it's a marketing challenge more than anything else, because there is always so much this perception that lawyers are just expensive and people are just afraid to even make that phone call to a lawyer and in the first place and find out what it might cost them to get actual legal services as opposed to services through some other non-legal provider. But so you've been as you said earlier, the first edition of this book came out in 2008. You've been blogging about this since 2002. It is now 2022. Is this a better time or a worse time to be a solo or small firm lawyer?
I feel like it's better. And again, you know, back in even 2007 or 8, it was still hard to know what everybody was doing. I mean, the internet was out there, but there still were a lot of solo and small firms that weren't fully engaged. And you didn't always read about these unique law firms that were being started or these different business models. But now it just seems like there's much more of that and it's much more visible. But I think, I mean, it's never been easier. The kind of technology packages that are available that are so easy to use, that are just at your fingertips, it's incredible. Things I never even dreamed of when I started my firm, like Skype calls or Zoom calls, Zoom platforms, or the document automation, the practice management tools, getting paid online. I mean, all of these things, like you'd never open a law firm today and like take paper checks, or hopefully you would not do that. So I just think the barriers have really just come down tremendously. So
yeah.
I think it's much better and definitely easier and more opportunities. Yeah. So that's what I'd vote for now to start.
Okay. What else would you like people to know about the book, or what else are you thinking about these days?
So I guess with the book, the one chapter I did add in the book was also the focus on work-life balance, taking vacations. It seemed irresponsible given the high level of suicides in amongst lawyers, and especially solo and small firm lawyers. It seemed really irresponsible not to include a chapter on ways to achieve more work-life balance and not work yourself into the ground. So that was another important part of the book. But this book is, like I said, this is the posterity edition, because I don't want to be Jay Foomberg. I feel like starting a firm today is so different from back when I did it. And I stay in touch with people who I know, people who are starting firms. I follow them and in all the different internet spaces, talk to people, but it's not the same experience for somebody who's been around for a long time as somebody who's just starting out. People are interested in new things and new ways of doing things. So I think this book will have like a 5-year, I think I wrote it far ahead enough that it will have a 5-year shelf life. And that will be the last one for me. So wait to see if somebody else, and hopefully somebody else will continue the tradition of writing about it. Because like you said, I mean, I feel like everything has become so commercialized and so much stuff that's put out there now is just a feeder into the coaching program or this program or that program. And I don't want to say anything negative about the programs. A lot of them have really accounted, many people attribute their success to a lot of those programs. Mm-hmm. But when you're starting out, you need to get money in the door. You can't do the programs unless you start making money. And, you know, so that's something that I for the same reason when I started, when I wrote the book in the beginning, the reason is still there. I feel like there should always be affordable resources for people who want to be able to start a firm so that they don't feel trapped in the situation that they're in.
Yeah. And the nice thing about the book is that it just, I mean, obviously some of the stuff you can find out if you want to go out and just sort of Google different resources and search, and but the book just pulls it all together in a very practical way. I mean, I didn't go, you know, we didn't talk chapter by chapter. You cover a whole lot of stuff in here. We've been talking more theoretical, but it's really, I mean, you know, it's a great book. It's a great resource, and I hope people will go out and get it and read it. And it's a and to be clear, it's a good resource. Even if you've already started your practice and are building up your practice. So this is not just for those who are considering starting a practice. Where can they buy it?
It's on Amazon or through my website, which will link to Amazon.
Okay. Well, Carolyn, thanks so much. It's been a real pleasure to catch up with you and talk to you. It's always good to see you.
This has been fun. So thank you.
All right. Well, the book, for all of you listening, we'll have links in the write-up, but it's Solo by Choice, How to Start Your Own Law Firm and Be the Lawyer You Always Wanted to Be. My guest was Carolyn Elephant. Thank you so much for being with us today. Good to talk to you.
Thanks.
I've been speaking today with Carolyn Elephant, publisher of MyShingle.com, the longest-running blog on solo and small firm law practice, and author of the book, Solo by Choice, How to Start a Law Firm and Be the Lawyer You Always Wanted to Be, for which she just released the third edition. You can find it at her website, myshingle.com, or on Amazon. What are your thoughts on today's show? Share them by tweeting us at LawNextPodcast. LawNext is produced, engineered, and edited by Populous Radio. I'm your host, Bob Ambrogi. I hope you'll join us again next time for another episode of Law Next.